Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Isaiah chapters 24 through 27. This forms a literary unit. It's a wonderful section. It's kind of a combination of apocalyptic literature and prophecy. And it deals with the end time, the universal judgment of God on the entire fallen world, and the restoration of the people of God in Jerusalem. This is almost a play on the two cities. Throughout these chapters, there's this city, and most of the time, it's a symbol of human society organized and functioning apart from God. It's this fallen world system. But then there's this city, which is like the city of Jerusalem, that's going to be the restored capital of the new kingdom. And it's a play on these two cities, these two powers. It's almost like a expansion of the phrase in Revelation, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our God and His Christ. In chapters 13 through 23, there was a series of judgments on all the nations, a judgment on Babylon, a judgment on Egypt, judgment on Assyria, judgment on all of Moab. And now this section kind of culminates that, draws it together in a universal judgment. This reminds me a whole lot of the prophecy in Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4, where Zion is symbolized as the end-time Savior of the world, that all the world will flow unto Zion, and Zion will be the home and the refuge of the one true God, the God of Israel. And that's what this is about. And my goodness, this is some section. It's really going to show us that God has had a plan from the beginning of time to redeem His people, and He's working on that plan. History is not a meaningless cycle. It's focusing into a point, and there will be a point in history when God sets up the new age, the new messianic kingdom. That's what we're talking about here. It's a really exciting chapter. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, and distorts its surface. Now here we have a play, I think, on the Noahic flood. As the Noahic flood was devastating and most of the world was leveled in that, this is even going to be more severe. Now, God promised that He wouldn't bring another flood, but this is using the flood as a metaphor of an end-time judgment that's worldwide in its scope. You might want to see Genesis 10 where it says, and scatters its inhabitants. And that kind of is the idea of what happened back after the flood. Mankind was dispersed, and it's this dispersion of the Tower of Babel that scatters all the world. And the people will be like priests and servants like master. Verse 2 is basically a series of what looks like diametrically opposite social kind of categories or distinctions. But in judgment, there will be no distinction. There'll be no rich and poor in judgment. There'll be no slave and free. There'll be no priest and parishioner. Mankind is going to suffer the judgment of God. All social distinctions are removed, and that's the same in verse 2 as it is in verse 4. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. Well, this little phrase, the Lord has spoken this word, reminds me of the Bible's emphasis on the power of the Word of God. And you might want to see Isaiah 55:11, where it says, my word does not go out from me void. Or you might want to see chapter 25:1, where it says, God has a plan from long ago. God is working out His will in His world, and what God says is what's going to happen. And that's what this idea is right here. You might also want to see chapter 25, verse 8, where it talked about the same thing. That okay, now notice, let's see. The earth mourns and withers, the world fades away and withers, the exalted of the people of the earth fade away. Now, here we have different references. Some think this is a reference to heaven, and the Revised Standard Version seems to follow our thing here. Others think it means heaven and earth, but I'm not sure I know exactly which it is. This would be a good place to notice that comparing English translations is often very helpful. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants. Now, this concept of the earth being polluted, or the earth suffering because of the sin of man, goes back to Genesis 3, verses 17 through 19, where the earth was cursed because of Adam's sin. And you might want to see Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 25, where it says, all creation groans until the revealing of the sons of God. And so that's the idea here, is this the earth is suffering because of the sin, the curse of God, and it's going to be redeemed. And notice it mentions by the inhabitants of what? Well, we're going to talk about a city. It doesn't really appear until verse 10. It's the inhabitants of the earth here, but it'll be kind of symbolized in the inhabitants of this rebellious city. For they transgressed the laws, violated the statutes. Now, many have said, what exactly is this talking about? Well, it seems to me that this everlasting covenant here is the covenant of Noah. And you might want to look at Genesis 8, 21 and 22, Genesis 9, 8 through 17. And I think there's an allusion to this destruction in 2 Peter 3:10. The earth's going to be destroyed by fire. And so here we have an idea of this everlasting covenant, and men have violated the laws. It's not so much the Mosaic law as maybe the idea in Romans in chapter 1, verses 19 and 20, in chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, that everybody should know God somehow from nature and from this inner moral witness, and that we're all responsible because we violated the light we have. And that seems to be the thrust of this, not so much the Mosaic law as the covenant with Noah. Therefore, a curse devours the earth. And again, you ought to see Genesis 3, 17 through 19, where this curse is alluded to. And those who live in it are held guilty. This is a moral universe. God is a moral God. We will give an account. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned. And here's this remnant idea, and few men are left. Now, this remnant concept is found several times. I've been teaching the Sermon on the Mount recently, and in Matthew chapter 7, verse 14, is this same idea of a few there are that find it. It's this common remnant concept. Now, beginning in verse 7, I think we're talking about a judgment as all this city has many social activities, but all these activities will be stopped. The wedding feast will be stopped. The harvest festivals will be stopped. All the normal things that men enjoy taking part in socially are going to be removed. And look in verse 10. The city of chaos is broken down. Now, the word chaos is the same word used in Genesis 1, 2 that means vain. So it's the city of emptiness, the city of vanity, the city of chaos. Now, notice there are several places in this few chapters where this idea of city comes in. Here is the city of chaos. In chapter 25, verses 2 and 3, it's the city is made into a heap. In verse 12, it's the unassailable city, speaking of Moab as a symbol of all the nations. And in chapter 26, verse 1, we have a strong city. And in verse 5, an unassailable city, where it's used more of God's new city. So it's this play on a destroyed city, the pride and rebellion of man, and yet this new eternal city, this God city, symbolized in the new Zion, chapter 26, 1 through 6. So really we have the fallen world system compared to the new kingdom. This is very similar to Augustine's tale of two cities, of the two cities, the city of God and the city of man. There is an outcry in the streets concerning wine. All joy is turned to gloom. Gaiety of earth is banished. All social events are stopped. Look at verse 13. For thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples. Now it's amazing to me through here how universal this passage gets. There's been some question among here about, are we talking about the scattered people of God, the Jews taken away in exile? Now the Assyrian exile would occur in Isaiah's life, and the Babylonian exile would be something that God revealed to him in the future. But are we talking about the people of God, or are we talking about all of humanity is going to be gathered? And there is some difference of opinion here. Sometimes it's Israel, literal Israel, and sometimes it's the wider concept of all people who respond to God by faith, including Gentiles. So let me give you a few different ways to look at this. If you see it as the scattered Jews, you might want to see Isaiah 11:11 and Isaiah 24:8, and focus in on that they were scattered during the exile to be restored. But if you're looking for all the people of God, you might want to see chapter 11, verse 10. And again, this idea of Egypt is going to be included as one symbol of one Gentile nation would be Isaiah 19, verses 18 through 25. That there's even going to be a call to Assyria and a call to Egypt to be a part of the people of God. And again, I'm not sure which it's referring to. But this allusion to a huge group of people can be seen in verse 14, can be seen in verse 16, can be seen in chapter 25, verse 6, verse 7, It's just repeated all the way through here. And I think because of the universal emphasis of Isaiah, we're talking about all the people of God. And notice, if you would, this remnant idea is still found in the end of verse 13, because after the shaking of a tree, it'd be like they shook the olive tree to get all the olives off, and after they went through the grape vineyard, they would take all the grapes off. Now, there's a few grapes left here. There's a few olives left here, and that's all that's going to be left after God's judgment, and that's the idea here. And notice it says, they cry out from the west, and then in verse 15, in the east. Now, this is this is not a literal west and east. It's two different plays on words. The word west is the word sea, and the word east is the word the region of light. But it means from the east to the west, I think. These people are going to come. It may refer to Egypt and Assyria. Assyria in the east, Egypt in the west. You might want to see chapter 19, verses 23 through 25. Notice it mentions here the coastlands in verse 15. Well, that comes from the Septuagint translation that says islands. And these islands are usually used to describe the Gentiles coming to God. You might want to see chapter 41, 5, chapter 42, verses 4 and 10, for just some examples of this. Look at this universal element in verse 16. From the ends of the earth, universal, from all the ends of the earth. Now, I think it's not just the people of God, but all peoples here. And what are all peoples going to do? Well, they're going to sing glory to the righteous one. My goodness, isn't this something? Now, some say the righteous one is a title for God. And, of course, that's what the Revised Standard Version and my New American Standard has. But King James and the American Standard Version has the righteous, meaning the people who've responded to God. They're the ones that are singing. They're singing, thank God for these who have turned to God. And it's the idea of a remnant again. Which it is, I'm not really sure. Now, notice where it says, woe. Now, in the middle of 16b, there's a drastic change of context here. And commentators go nutso on trying to figure out who is talking. Suddenly, in the midst of this praising God for universal judgment that has spared some who trust Him, the prophet says, woe to me, woe to me, alas for me. Now, this has been translated a million ways. It's a powerful wordplay here. It looks to me like that's very common in Isaiah, is this kind of going back and forth between judgment and praise and judgment and praise. It's just characteristic of this literature, particularly Isaiah. And we have that break right here. Unfortunately, it comes right in a verse division, but you know that verses are not inspired, neither are chapters in this ancient literature. So the prophet is crying out. Now, why is he crying out? Is he crying out because a God is going to judge the earth or judge him or what? Well, I'm not sure, but look at the end of verse 16. Another really strong wordplay, and here we're comparing English translations will show you the creative way that translators have done it. The treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal treacherously. And so you see it's kind of a wordplay of four different Hebrew words that rhyme. Now, in verse 17, we have terror, pit, and snare. Now, this is a play on terms for capturing animals. And you might well see Jeremiah 48, verses 43 and 44 for a similar play. Notice if you drop down the end of verse 18, for the widows, the windows above are open and the foundations of the earth shake. Now, this again, I think, is an allusion to the flood. The windows were opened. That's Genesis 7, 11 and 8, 2. And I think we've been playing on this. Basically, verse 18 is no one will escape God's judgment. You'll flee from one disaster, but you'll fall into another. And you might want to see Amos 5:19 for a parallel. And this idea that the earth is split, violently shaken, this is more than an earthquake. This is this total destruction, this cataclysmic event as on the scale of Noah's flood that we're talking about. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard. Now, this is often used as a metaphor for judgment. You might want to see Isaiah 19:14, Isaiah 28:7 and 8. And notice it says it totters like a shack. That's an allusion to something that's very unsturdy and flimsy. You might want to see chapter 1, verse 8. Notice in verse 21, this little phrase, the host of heaven. Now, usually that refers to the astral worship of Babylon. But in this context, I don't think it refers to that. It's in kind of a play relationship or a parallel relationship with the kings of the earth. It looks like to me we're talking about the angelic leaders of nations. We see some of that in Daniel chapter 10 and also in Deuteronomy 32:8 in the Septuagint, where it says God appointed an angel for every nation. So I think these are the national angels that have allowed evil to come in and have even cooperated with evil that are going to be judged along with the kings of the earth. Okay? These angelic spirits are going to be put in prison along with the kings. It kind of reminds you a whole lot of Jude chapter 6 or 2 Peter 2:4 or even Revelation 20 verses 1 through 3 where Satan is bound and chained. It's, of course, metaphorical, but even spirits can be spoken of in this term. So all the powers are going to be judged and sent to the holding place or the prison. And that's the word tartarus used in Jude for those angels that kept not their proper state. And after many days, now some say, oh, that's the millennium. Well, I don't know what that is. I guess you could take it to that, be that. But after many days, they will be punished. And the word here is visited. The word visited can be used for positive and negative. And here, of course, it seems to be very negative. And look in verse 23. Mount Zion is going to be lifted up again. I think that's tremendous. Because of the presence of the Lord, earth is going to quake and shake, and all kind of things are going to happen on earth because God is coming in judgment. For several other of these places, you might want to see Isaiah 60, 19, and 20, and Revelation 21, 23, and Revelation 22, 5, that there's not going to be any need for sun or moon because God will be there and God will provide the light. And so here Mount Zion is a headquarters of world faith because that's where the God of Israel chose to rest. And of course, you might go back to Isaiah 2, 2 through 4. Now, in the second of the chapter, Isaiah is characteristic of judgment and praise, just like the book of the Revelation. And so here we start out with, O God, Thou art my God. These next few verses are so personal. He's talking about, like, my shepherd. So many personal pronouns. This prophet knew God. I will exalt Thee. I will give thanks to Thy name, for Thy works are wonders. Seems like he knew the Psalms well and is quoting from many of them. Notice it says, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. Now, this is some extent the basis for Calvinism, where we have that God long ago has set the boundaries of nations and men. And what we have here, of course, is this idea of a plan that is working out. History is not on a willy-nilly course. It's moving toward a point. And you might want to see, let's see if I have some other verses here. Yes, Isaiah 14, verses 24, verses 26 and 27, Isaiah 23, verses 8 and 9, for these plans long ago. And I think we have to believe that God is sovereign and God is in control of the world, even when we don't understand everything that's happening in history. Then notice again in verse 2, we have the city into a heap. And here again we have this symbolic judgment on this one city, and the city represents fallen humanity rebelling against God. It'll never be rebuilt, it says in the end of verse 2. Look at verse 3. Cities of ruthless nations will revere thee. What God's going to do in judgment will cause the world to come to God. Notice in verses 4 and following, this characteristic Deuteronomy element about that God loves the widow, the orphan, and the alien. Those who have been socially ostracized are now going to be welcomed by God. I think that's beautiful. Now in verse 6, we have this messianic banquet, that God's going to set this lavish banquet, not for the Jews only, but for all the peoples of the earth. Notice how many times it says, verse 6, for all the peoples on this mountain. Look at verse 7, for all the peoples. And again, in the latter part of verse 7, all the nations. Oh my, this is the universal reign of God, as it was the universal judgment of God. Let's go through a little bit more. This is very similar to the messianic banquet of Revelation 19:9. So it's a banquet of the best food, the best wines, all of that is there. Now this idea of the veil or the covering that is over the people will be removed in verse 7. What is that all about? Well, some say the veil is a sign of mourning, and a good example would be 2 Samuel 15:30. Some say the veil is a sign of shame, and maybe 2 Samuel 19:5 and Jeremiah 14:3. And some say that the veil is a sign of blindness, as it was used by Paul in 1 Corinthians 3:15. And exactly what it is, I don't know, but God's going to remove the shame, the blindness, and the mourning. And maybe it means all three of them. It's beautiful. And here's this beautiful passage that all of us have heard. And he will swallow up death for all time. Oh, you might want to see Isaiah 26:19. This is quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15:54, and it's quoted so often in the New Testament and the book of Revelation. He's going to wipe away every tear from their eye. Now, this looks like the eternal kingdom to me. This is not the millennial kingdom. This is the eternal kingdom. And you might want to see Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14. Death is swallowed up. God will wipe away every tear. He'll remove the reproach from His people, from all the earth. And my, what a wonderful day is coming. Now, notice where it says at the end of verse 8, "For the Lord has spoken." You can mark it down. You can put it in the bank. It's going to happen because God said it. Now, some of this prophecy is somewhat ambiguous, and we don't know exactly when and how in history it's going to be fulfilled, but God's going to bring all men into judgment, and God's going to bless His people with His presence. And that's what's going to happen here. Look at verse 9. "And it will be said, in that day..." Now, this is the day of salvation. We've talked about that day back in Isaiah chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. We're going to make a play on that day in chapter 26, 1 and 27, 1 and 2. This is all one literary unit. And so in that day, what day is it? Well, it's Judgment Day for those who don't know Him. It's Resurrection and Banquet Day for those of us who do. Notice what's going to happen. "Behold, this is our God, for whom we have waited, that He might save us. This is the Lord, for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in His salvation." His people suffered. His people were exiled. His people were ostracized, and yet they waited on God, and God came through with His promises. God has a plan. You can count on His plan. You can count on His promises. There may be suffering in your day. There may be problems in your day, but God's going to bring it to pass because the honor and power of His name are involved. Now, verses 10 through 12 is very unusual. It's like we return to the judgment metaphor. We've talked in earlier about Moab being judged. It was one of the groups judged back in chapters 13 through 23. And here Moab comes again. Now, why Moab comes again, we're not certain. Moab is singled out for the judgment of God several times in the Bible because of how, though it was a relative of Israel, it participated in the judgment that God sent through other nations on Israel. Moab is used as a symbol of all nations in their pride, in their rebellion, because Moab was built up on a high plateau, and she felt like she was safe because she was built high, and that she had trade routes going through her, so she was very wealthy. She was known for her wisdom. All these things combined to make Moab a prideful, arrogant symbol of all human beings apart from God. And that's exactly what we have here. I realize it's a real switch from this wonderful, universal, messianic banquet, and then bingo, we're right back into a judgment theme, but that is what is characteristic of this place. Matter of fact, I think, and we're not going to cover it tonight, but chapter 26, down in verse 5, talks about that the unassailable city has been brought low. I think that's another allusion to Moab, this haughty pride of her physical location, high up where the eagles nest. "No one can get me." And God says, "Really? Really? You think you can't be touched by anyone?" And so here God brings them. Notice how serious this is. "But the Lord will lay low His pride together with the trickery of His hands. And the unassailable fortifications of your walls He will bring down. And lay low and cast to the ground, even to the dust." And here we have an allusion of the terrible judgment that's going to fall on Moab as a symbol of all rebellious, haughty people. It reminds me a whole lot of Psalm 2, where the kings of this earth rail against God and His Messiah. But in the end, it is God that does what He wants to with His world. And this is a moral world, and we serve an ethical God, and one day men are going to give account. You can almost take these two things back. The allusion back to Noah's flood and the allusion to the scattering of the Tower of Babel is going back to the problems of men starting in the curse of Genesis 3. Man wants to do his own thing. Man wants to run his own life. Man wants to steer his own ship. And God says, "No, I'm God. And if you choose to rebel, you're going to pay the price." So here we have man, human society organized and functioning apart from God. Man is the standard of all things, humanism. And God says, "No, it's those hurting, those ostracized people that you've afflicted and scattered, those are the ones who are going to have a day of ease and joy and be with me. And those of you who thought by your own power and your own might you could make your own destinies, I have a plan. And I'm working it out. And judgment and the new age, the new messianic age, are in my plan. And I'm going to bring it to pass. And nothing human is going to stop me." So I think this is the first two chapters of this four-chapter literary unit. And I think we have to hold them together. It's a black and a white picture now. It's going to move easily between both sides. The blackness is the judgment of God on human beings, and the glory is that God will not give up on us. We'd all deserve to die. We've all rebelled, but He's planning to redeem a remnant. He's planning to bring them back to the land that He promised them. He's planning through the seed He promised Abraham to bring all, whoever they are, Jews and Gentiles, to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I think there's no other prophet in all the Old Testament that has the universal judgment as Isaiah does, or the universal call to salvation that Isaiah does. This is a marvelous literary unit. Our God does reign, and as He reigns in heaven, so may it be on earth, is this end-time judgment section. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.